So I was walking to the hall, you know, paying careful attention to my stepping and my my environment, and I was just beginning to come up the stairs. I realized that I very mindfully misplaced my glasses. So that's, I'm a little late, and I borrowed these from somewhere, and so we'll see how this works for me. So just folding it all in, you know, that's what we do, you know, things don't always go the way we plan. So today I'm going to talk a little about the doing side of things. The doing side of practice, you know, the dharma of making choices and decisions that we might make. In Buddhist practice, an essential aspect of wisdom is having the clarity of mind to see the differences between the options we have at any given moment. And what's available? What are the choices we have? And making the choices that lead towards our well-being as opposed to making choices that lead to suffering. This refers to both the choices that we make in our daily life, the choices that we make, you know, just with an ordinary mind when we first sit and practice, and the choices that we make when we go into the very depths of this practice. you know, we, in our daily lives, you know, we're all familiar with just, we make choice after choice after choice, right? What do we have for dinner? Do I call them back? How do I respond to that person? How do I, meet the person I disagree with? And in our meditation, you know, we're always choosing, you know, when we're even a little bit aware, you know, we make that choice. Do I follow that fantasy? Oh, I really want to follow that juicy, juicy fantasy. Or I'll go back to my breath, which at this moment doesn't feel all that interesting. You know, how do we meet those choices? You know, Matthew and I, of course, just had to make kind of one of these big daily choices a couple of days ago. We had to decide whether to cancel the retreat because of the, you know, what was happening with the storm. And so, choices. When we first purchased this property about 12 years ago, we had to do a really major, major remodel and build out and in a very short period of time. And having had zero experience as a project manager, I was the project manager. And you know, and because of the time, you know, I found that there were many, many more choices than I really had the time to make as skillfully and wisely, you know, and carefully as I could have. You know, but I realized that the practice, what it pointed to, wasn't about somehow magically making every choice that I made the best choice, but it was about making all those choices, including the ones that were probably going to turn out to be mistakes, with a peaceful heart. And the other thing I realized that it was much easier for me to make the big decisions, you know, like the layout of the place and what appliances to buy, than the aesthetic choices, like the color of the zabutons, the color of the zafus, the flooring, the aesthetic parts. And, you know, and I pondered that, you know, why is it so hard to make these, what seem like the, you know, it's a little more important what the, you know, what the structure of this place is, right? But those are the visible parts. Those are the parts that all of you would get to see. And, you know, and I had mixed intentions. was creating a lot of stress in me because, you know, primarily I wanted to create a peaceful place where we could all meditate and we could all really have, really nourish us. You know, that was my primary intention. But this other piece was I really wanted you all to like it. You know, so we had committees, right, you know, in the aesthetic things, you know, and one of the ones that really stands out in my memory the most is when we're choosing the color of the paint for the place, because we use the same paint everywhere. And you know, we had kind of narrowed it down to 8 samples. And, you know, we were indecisive, so we went to Redwood City. And I think, well, all of you or most of you know Gil, right? He's the co-founder here. And, you know, so, you know, he likes to, you know, we used to tease him that he's the aesthetic czar, you know. And so we brought the 8 samples and we sat there for 2.5 hours. Back and forth and back and forth. And finally, you know, I was just kind of stunned, a little bit stunned what was happening. He kind of points to it. He goes, I think I have a slight preference for that one. I said, okay. And, you know, I brought it here and, you know, about to order it, you know, and then I brought it up here, you know, it was like a really nice morning and I put it there and I go, I don't like it. And in that moment, I just chose another one, you know, and this is what you have, and you better all like it. But, you know, just what goes into choices, you know, what are these little extras we do, these little extras? You know, when we're stressed in making a choice, when we feel stressed, a decision, a choice, you know, mindfulness reveals what we're clinging to. So, you know, instead of like hating these choices, oh God, I've got to decide this or that, you know, what are we clinging to? You know, one of the things that became so blatantly obvious, you know, there's people I mentor that, you know, had all this holiday stuff going on. You know, I don't know if any of you had, you know, holidays, you know, Thanksgiving or Christmas holidays and where you, you know, had people over, cooked for them and did things like that. Almost all of them were so stressed by it. You know, what am I gonna cook? Who am I gonna invite? And am I gonna get it done in time? And all this extra, you know? And so, you know, so instead of not liking it, avoiding it, mindfulness can bring what a great time to become wise, you know, over, you know, what am I making for dinner? You know, are they going to like it? Oh, you know, I want them to like it. You know, I want them to think I'm a good cook. You know, all this little extra, you know, the one thing about these things in our mind, you know, when we look at them, you know, we look foolish to ourselves, right? You know, we sort of, but it's actually in a way, the things in our minds that we cling to are no different than the little kid who will throw a tantrum if they don't get their ice cream, you know, or they'll go around bragging, you know, my daddy's better than yours, you know. And, you know, we see it in a kid and we go, oh, yeah, you know, kind of laugh, you know. But those are the kind of voices that kind of tend to run us. You know, in terms of in my early years of meditation, you know, I was exposed to a few too many techniques, too many methods, and I spent one retreat where I just would take chunks of time and I'd do this method, and then I'd go, well, maybe the other one's correct, and then I'd go to the other method, and I basically never settled because I was just going back and forth with indecision. You know, and never once looking at my process, never once being mindful of, oh, what was happening really was confusion and doubt. And with confusion and doubt, you know, seeing it is the practice. Seeing or confusion is the practice. Seeing or doubt is the practice. Not that it's not useful to talk to a teacher, get things clarified, but really seeing what's happening in ourselves. What is in the moment creating the stress? Where's Matthew's water? this is mine, right? Yeah. When we're not mindful, the mind resorts to its habitual ways of thinking. You know, and if you're the kind of person who tends to worry a lot, if the mind doesn't have much to do, it kind of ends up going there. If you're a planner, you know, the mind goes into planning. If you're someone who has this, you know, really helpful disposition, maybe you think about, oh, is there somebody I can help? You know, like, you know, it's at the treehouse right before the talk, you know, and Nisha just, you know, several times came up and said, you know, can I do something for you? Can I help? Can I, you know, that's just her natural inclination. It was so sweet. But these habits of mind, you know, that we have, we all have, if we're not really completely free, we have some habits of mind, you know, like turning towards what's wrong with us, you know, how we're not good enough, all these habits. And when we're direct the mind, you know, we're paying attention to what's at play right now. But the moment the mind is no longer mindful, and if something really good and tempting is nearby, the mind gets, oh, I want that. You know, but if something that we don't like is happening, right, we want to get rid of it. But if not much is happening, we go into these other baseline habits of mind. And the reason, you know, I'm mentioning this is that in practice, you know, one of the definitions of enlightenment is the unconditioned. It's a mind that doesn't go into habitual ways of being. It's really a mind that's free of habit. It's free of that level of habit. When we bring mindfulness to a moment, we create more space around it, even as if a difficult moment. And that space we create around it gives us a moment of choice instead of just being run by the way we're used to being run. For instance, if you're having a disagreement with someone, you know, and it's, you know, we might get caught in aversion or clinging to being right, or I'm going to convince the other person, you know, maybe even having ill will towards them. But quite easily we just can get caught in this really unhelpful argument with that. You know, I think, I don't know if you've been in a situation where neither person's listening and they're both talking, you know, that, you know, that's what we get caught by. But if there's awareness, then there can be enough space to make the choice to feel those really, you know, I really want to make my point, you know, and really see that even though I really want to make my point, and I know they're not listening, you know, that's not skillful. And in that moment, that little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of space, gives us the choice to refrain. And like Matthew, I love the image he gave this morning about Nico, his nephew, you know, or, you know, hugging themselves, like to restrain themselves from taking from the other child, stop myself, you know, sometimes that's what we need. But I think it's beautiful that he held himself, hugged himself, because that's really what we're doing when we refrain, because we see the wisdom of refraining. We're loving ourselves. We're giving a gift to ourselves, we're hugging ourselves, even though it's hard. You know, in meditation, you know, you know, I, you know, you've probably all had like a really difficult sit that when it was over, you go, God, I'm glad that's over. You know, it's just like really dukkha, you know, really dukkha sit. And, you know, and in the middle of the sit, you know, I mean, not necessarily when it's over, you know, you know, sometimes what my mind has tended to do at that time is, okay, I get to reward myself now. It's over. I'm feeling kind of nice and peaceful. I'm going to go on a fantasy. I deserve it. You know, so it's really easy to make that some choices at those times because, you know, we've gone from strong attention to the dukkha, really strong attention to all this painful experience. And now there's not that much happening. Things are easeful. And my habit is to go fantasize. You know, and at that moment, I can bring enough mindfulness to choose differently. The thing to really recognize about these habits of mind is that they reinforce themselves. Every single time, you know, we follow the distraction, makes us, strengthens the tendency of the mind to be distracted. Every single time we go in the direction of mindfulness, it strengthens the tendency to be mindful. And that's how we develop any skill. You know, if you're learning the piano, you know, if you hit a wrong note and then you're kind of careless, you end up hitting that wrong note a lot, you know, unless you really correct it, you know, and you know, you play a piece and you facilitate it. When you do it well, you facilitate it. It's easier to do it. This is the process of learning, the process of developing the tendencies, the habits that bring us in the direction, in the skillful direction. Sometimes we don't really recognize, you know, staying on the same point, one more thing about it is that, you know, if we encourage or anger, we immediately have a consequence. Our whole body gets flooded with hormones. There's an immediate effect. If we have a moment of loving kindness, our body is flooded with other hormones that are so we have an immediate effect. You know, one is actually harmful to the body, and one is actually helpful to the body, to the mind, to the heart. But if we you know, in a difficult situation, whether it's internal or external, if we choose to respond with even the slightest inclination towards friendliness, just a little bit of an inclination towards friendliness, we can experience an immediate ease in the body and mind. I remember the first time I experienced this, I was having an argument with my husband. You know, and I was really riled up, you know, and you know, all this impetus, and you know, I was gonna win the argument, and you know, Dharma showed up, you know, like a little nag there saying, hey, you know, look what's happening, and I go, okay, I know I don't want to, but I'm planning to let go of this anger, I'm planning to let it go, and I felt like the full intensity of the anger. And I just felt it and stayed with it. And it left. It eventually left. I'm sure none of you in this moment have the anger you had last time you had, you know, you felt it. You know, it's gone. You know, and it does go. It all goes by itself. But it's that inclination that little bit of that friendliness allowed that to happen in a way that without getting caught in the argument itself. I really learned to appreciate what the inclination of the mind means, you know, to incline the mind towards loving kindness, to incline the mind towards patience. If you think about the way that, sometimes if you've had to wake up in the morning and you at a different time than normal, and so you set the alarm clock and you wake up right before the alarm clock, you know, many of you have had that experience, right? And what happens? You inclined your mind in that direction and your subconscious did the work. You know, something in you knew and something in you figured it out and did that. And the same thing happens when we incline the mind towards friendliness. We don't force the mind into friendliness. You know, we don't force the mind to feel love. We don't force the mind not to be restless. You know, don't be restless, you know. That just agitates the mind even more. But what we do is we give a room. We give a room. We give it space. And that's what mindfulness does. That's what awareness does. We say, oh, it's okay that I'm restless. Here it is. This is what restlessness is like. This is what it's like. And we're friendly. We incline towards giving it space. There's a metaphor often used about crossing the great water to get to the other shore. And the metaphor is, this shore is full of danger. You know, it's full of stress and danger and lots of dukkha. So we cross the water to the safety and ease of the other shore. And we do that by purifying the mind of these unhelpful habits. But when we get to the other shore, we no longer need the raft. We no longer depend on our helpful habits. But that's the ideal, the goal of the theoretical goal of enlightenment, right? But we can feel the benefit of wise choices, because every time we make a wise choice, there's just a little bit less dukkha. There's a little less dukkha, a little less suffering in us. You know, inclining the mind has patience in it, has patience built into it. Patience is the way we practice being peaceful. You know, I think that Gil told me this. He said that, in Buddhism, there's these 10 paramis, these 10 qualities that we all have. That we develop that are needed to be strengthened and perfected to be awakened. You know, qualities like generosity and virtue and loving kindness and equanimity and the one that he said he looked them up. You know, he likes to play with the suttas. You know, and the one that was there the most of all the qualities of the 10 paramis was patience. It was the one that was used the most. And so. So patience is a great teacher. Patience is a great teacher. You know, metta practice, you know, is an example of the way we can incline the mind. You know, may I be happy? May I be peaceful? Just inclining in the direction of peace. Choices can have an emotional weight. Sometimes we don't like making choices or decisions because it feels unpleasant. You know, their decisions sometimes have a very unpleasant vedana and a pleasant flavor in the mind. But, you know, we talk about weighty decisions, heavy choice, tough decision. We use those words, you know, and some of the weight is natural, you know, because some decisions have much bigger consequences than others. And they might take a lot of work, a lot of careful consideration. You know, should I move? Should I take this job? Should I, you know, engage in something? Should I go on this retreat, right? but often we add a lot of unnecessary weight and meaning to making choices. And the idea that there's a right choice can have a lot of emotional weight. One of the things I tortured myself with was that I needed to breathe correctly, that I wasn't just supposed to watch my breath, but I was supposed to watch my breath, but it had to be a certain way. My breath had to be smooth. It had to be kind of perfect. It had to be just right. And I wasn't quite sure when it was just right. And, you know, it added all this weight, you know, so how do you relax into that? You know, how do we, you know, not add the extra? We have to see the extra, that it's not needed. No, just like it is, we look at things just as they are. Right now, the breath is choppy. Okay, is there something I can relax? Okay, I can relax my shoulders. Okay. Breath is still choppy. That's okay. This is how the breath is. But that there's a right way of being. You know, that there's the right way of doing something or even of feeling something, you know. I remember it was at a training, you know, and it was part of teacher training. And there was a large group of people, about, you know, 50 people in the room, and somebody brought their baby. And brought their baby, which is very sweet to see them, and put the baby kind of in the middle of the circle, which was very, very sweet. And, you know, and then we're trying to do like some kind of deep communication among the whole group of people. And the baby is not being a sweet baby in that moment, but being kind of very excited and very excitable. And I got really irritated. And I really didn't like it, but I also felt like everybody's looking like this is the Buddha, and, you know, and I'm getting irritated. I don't have the right to feel the way I'm feeling, you know, and this much more courageous woman near me, she said, you know, I love children, you know, I got 3 grandchildren at home, and I love them to death. But when I come here, I don't want to deal with children, you know, and it wasn't a problem. She was okay with how she felt. That she was okay with how she felt. This is how she felt. And to me, that was a great teaching. That just like, I'll give you another example. That was, again, this is a retreat example. You know, at the end of retreats, often people are like in really kind of very blissful states, very loving, open-hearted. And I ended the retreat and I was kind of really uptight, you know, and not uptight, but I was just didn't feel social. I felt uncomfortable being social. I didn't feel outgoing. I just wanted to, I was at a place, the retreat took me to a place where I really wanted to keep practicing and going into meeting people and saying hello and socializing was just like dukkha for me, you know, and I was like, I'm feeling this weight of it, you know, because I thought I was supposed to be like everybody else. I was supposed to be up. You know, and again, it was another yogi who gave me the lesson. You know, they said, you know, I'm feeling really sad right now. I'm just feeling really sad, you know, and they just said how it was for them. And it was just, she just spoke the truth. And it's like, oh, of course, this is a safe place. You know, we don't have to be anything other than we are. And you know, what I've learned with practice is that the more honest I am, the more I express myself the way I am, you know, warts and all, the more my practice grows. The other piece is making mistakes or make choices, you know, fear of making mistakes, you know. In this culture, you know, we have the idea that there's good taste, you know. Oh, they have really good taste, you know, and they don't have good taste, you know. We're supposed to feel a certain way. We're supposed to like a certain thing. And the story reminds me, you know, when I was in my teens, you know, there was a thing called Muzak. Is that a thing anymore? You know, and Muzak, if you don't know, it's often called elevator music. It's like kind of this background music that was mostly used in commercial environments, you know. Growing up, you know, me and my friends, we just had an incredible disdain and hatred for it, you know, and we called it the shallow anti music, you know. That was, so the clock goes forward about 20 more years, you know, and in my 30s, and I set a 3-week retreat in Yucca Valley, you know, and it's one of these places where there's, at least at the time, there are almost no restaurants, you know, and we were really hungry at the end of the retreat. And so we found the one local joint, I walk in and there's music playing and I stop and it was Muzak. And the song was Yesterday, one of my favorite Beatles songs, right? In Muzak style. And I was so moved. I started crying. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. and then I just started, I kept crying with laughter because, you know, just the irony of all of it, you know, of just the way I had held it, you know, that came through. But you know, sometimes we add a lot of suffering around making mistakes, you know, and so we try not to make choices so we don't make mistakes. And yet mistakes are inherent in the learning process. Any learning process is based on making mistake after mistake. Niels Bohr, who was a Nobel Prize winner in physics, he said, an expert is one who has made all the mistakes which can be made in a narrow field. I mean, I love that. I love that, you know. I'll just tell you a little story. You know, when I was first volunteering for IMC, this is like way back in 25 years ago, you know, and we had just started having like email lists and things like that, you know, and I was the moderator, you know, the one who answered all the questions about IMC, you know, you know, and I'd post anything special happening, and then, you know, I did that for like 2 or 3 years. You know, I was really, got really good at it, and I enjoyed doing it. And then I passed on the job to someone else, and they were terrible at it. But the nature of it was that nobody knew that it wasn't me. You know, so after they'd make some horrible mistake, you know, and I'd get on there and I'd correct the mistake so everybody have the right information, but make it really clear that I'm not the one who made the mistake, you know. And after like probably the fifth time I did that, I hate to say it, maybe even more, I finally decided, okay, this is ridiculous. I'm going to practice with it. And I actually took that on as a practice, just, you know, and this person gave me lots of opportunity to practice. It was great. You know, and I just practiced really experiencing, you know, people thinking that I made these mistakes, you know, and it's amazing how much dukkha there was there in me. But it was a great practice, you know, it's a great practice. It's what allowed me to not be too embarrassed that I forgot my lost my glasses. You know, the other thing about making choices is that, you know, sometimes there is an obviously right and wholesome choice. You know, I probably most of you would agree that eating the third piece of pie isn't so good. You know, it's pretty clear, right? You know, but sometimes we have no way of knowing. You know, we have to make choices and we don't know. We just don't know. You know, and to be at peace with that we're going to make a choice, and it's just totally unknown, and that's really, you know, this is how what life is like. You know, we think we make a choice and we know what's going to happen, but things don't always turn out the way we think by the choice we make. But we keep thinking that we can control it, that somehow, you know, if we just make the right choice, everything in our life will be okay. We just have to, you know, if we just make the right decision, do the right thing, everything will be okay. You know, the first choice we make in meditation, you know, Satipatthana Sutta, you know, says, you know, putting aside greed and distress for the world. Just really putting aside all our concerns with the world. That's what we do when we come and sit and meditate. We say, I've made the choice. I mean, you're not here on retreat to figure out how to remodel your house or what color paint I used, you know, you know, you're here to go inward, to really discover what's in here, and to free your hearts. And you know, our job is to really see clearly what our experience is, and the part of the and now we're bringing choice to a much more intimate level, that is what's really happening in our practice, is what happens in the fact room investigation. You know, we're mindful and we investigate the moment. Investigation is seeing the differences between things, the distinctions between things, and it's part of what we've all been doing. And, you know, the difference between a tense shoulder and a relaxed shoulder. You know, the difference between a distracted mind and undistracted mind. So this is what we're seeing, you know, and at first, like when we sit down, we're not very settled, you know, it's very obvious, you know, oh, yep, distracted, not distracted. But as the mind gets quieter, the distinctions become much more subtle, much more subtle. You know, when I was a child, I was very nearsighted, but I guess that's why I'm telling it. Okay. But I didn't have glasses. You know, I wasn't given glasses. And so, you know, but I was, you know, I saw these children's books, you know, and, you know, I lived in a big city that was really flat, and I'd never seen, you know, hadn't really seen, been in mountains or hills or anything like that. It was just very flat. And then I'd see these little picture books. And one time we went on the train, and we went across some mountains, And, you know, I saw these beautiful green rolling hills, you know, and I was just so amazed. They were so beautiful. And I just, you know, pictured them just like the picture book, you know, where these little smooth things I could roll down on, you know, it just looked so, so perfect. And I actually believed that hills and mountains were smooth. And you know, when I was 12, I went my first hiking trip, and I had glasses. And, you know, and I was shocked. I said, everything is rough and uncomfortable. and there's nothing I can roll down on here, you know. And but investigation's a little bit like putting on the glasses, you know, really seeing what's there, really seeing what's there instead of the idea we have of what's there. You know, it's not meant, it's meant to be an intimate noticing, not a thinking about it. You know, sometimes, you know, the word investigation, you know, it sometimes has too much the idea that we're being intellectual, that there's some kind of intellectual thing happening. But it's an intimate knowing when you really look. You know, if you really look at the face of someone you love, you know, you're not necessarily, you're not thinking about it, you're just looking at them, seeing the details, seeing the brightness in their eyes, seeing their smile. You know, you're not analyzing it. You know, oh, their eyes are bright. Yeah, they're, you know, you're just appreciating being close to it, being intimate. And this is the quality of investigation, is just being so close to it, so, so intimate with it. If you take something more unpleasant in practice, like pain, you know, maybe there's a knee pain, and you know, we can see it at, oh, that's a pain, painful knee. You know, you're kind of removed from it, but when you get really close to it, you see that, oh, there's a pinching there, and there's a burning there, and that spot's much more intense than this spot, and there's like so many changing sensations that it's very alive, very alive, very changing. And so that's investigation, seeing it really as it is. When a hindrance arises, we make a choice to, we can make the choice to incline the mind to be friendly towards it. You know, not to view the hindrances as something we're doing wrong. You know, I think for me, a real turning point in practice was the first time that I had some kind of really strong aversion. I don't even remember what it was. It was, you know, aversion, I think, to a yogi snoring really loud next to me, you know, and I was like, you know, really hating it, really hating it. It was ruining my meditation, you know. And then I really decided to, okay, I've had the teachings. I'm going to really apply to this aversion, you know, the friendliness to how I'm feeling, to this hatred of the snoring, you know, and I hung with it, you know, and went through it until it dissipated, and then it was gone, and the hindrance felt just like birds chirping outside. It was just intimate. It was actually, you know, it's not that it was pleasant, but it felt close. It felt intimate. And it just was, and it didn't feel like it was an interruption of my practice. It didn't feel like I had done something wrong. It didn't feel, it was just, oh yeah, the birds are chirping outside. Oh yeah, anger arose. Oh, a desire arose, you know, warmth, feeling beautiful warmth, feeling nice sensations in my legs, feeling restlessness arose. You know, it just kind of folds in if we're with it and we don't resist it. We're just, Yes, yes. All of you are welcome. All of you are welcome here. Ajahn Sumedho describes investigation. He calls it affectionate curiosity. I love that word. I love that way of thinking of it. You know, it's comes about an attitude of caring for ourselves and caring for others and caring for the world. You know, it's warm, affectionate curiosity. There's no strain. And it's this wisdom where we see all the details of our experience and we open to them and we say yes to what shows up. It's what allows us to have the ability to see the difference between what we think is permanent and the reality that it's not. What we think is, this is me, and the reality that, well, that's not me either. You know, when we look, you know, we don't find someone there that's consistent. You know, sometimes I think about, you know, my 10-year-old self. It's like, what do I recognize in them? What in that 10-year-old is here right now? You know, that but yet the mind believes, you know, this is me. This is really me. I don't remember most of my me moments, right? You know, I mean, gosh, most of my life, it's absolutely gone from my memory. And this is what discriminating wisdom, you know, this is the Dhammapachaya, discriminating wisdom, the wisdom that allows us to see through these delusions of permanence. Thinking that something will satisfy us. If we just get everything we want, then we'll be satisfied. And somehow forever, you know, happily ever after, right? We many of us grew up with happily ever after. So I'll just end with a quote from Ajahn Chah. Peace is within oneself, to be found in the same place as agitation and suffering. It's not found in a forest or a hilltop, nor is it given by a teacher. Where you experience suffering, you can find freedom from suffering. Trying to run away from suffering is actually to run towards it. So thank you. Let's sit for just 1 minute, just to